Say good evening.
Good evening.
That's better. Thank you. Welcome to our Skeptics Forum tonight. There's a lot of faces in this crowd I've never seen before. Who has never before been in this room? Wow, that is awesome. Okay, I hope you brought some really great questions. We've got a Skeptics Forum tonight. It's an open question. Skeptics Forum will take questions on anything relating to the Bible or philosophy or science or hockey. No, I'm just kidding. Okay. Couple of comments. This Skeptics Forum is, yes, James, you've got a question already?
Any good idea if everyone starts lining up here and that line goes this way?
You want to police the line?
No.
Okay, all right. This Skeptics Forum is sponsored by Paradox Class in this very room every Sunday at 11 o'clock, 11:15, whenever we get to it. Dr. Ross teaches Sunday school class in this room, and we hash out debating issues on science and faith and those kind of things. It's a very exciting class. It's a class I've been going to for about 12 years. And personally, I can say that it is the one thing I've done in my Christian walk that has made the most difference in my closeness to the Lord is being in this class. So, thank you. A couple of comments. I made this statement. How many people were at the forum we did yesterday? Anybody? Well, you'll hear me say it again. I think we're at the point where we can say that the evidence for the scientific evidence, the philosophical evidence for a creator, specifically the Christian creator, is stronger than the evidence that it all happened by itself. There's a really cool book I've been reading. It's been around for a while, but the title says what I'm saying. It's written by Norm Geisler and Frank Turek, and it's called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. It's a good book. Pick it up. Okay, there's a microphone back there. We hope you brought some good questions. I always say this, we want some provocative questions. We don't want nice church questions, okay? We want tough, non-politically correct, interesting, juicy questions. Okay, there's a microphone back there. You're free to ask as many questions as you like, but if there is a line, please ask your question. Go to the end of the line and you can ask another question. Yes?
Okay.
We're going to go till 9 o'clock. We'll probably take a break around 8. If you are a little shy to come to the mic and you want to ask a question anyway, write it down on a piece of paper and hand it to James right there, and James will hand it to me. I'm serious. I need somebody because Dave's not here. So stand up. Dave's not here. All right. James, you're the question taker. All right. So if anybody wants to ask a question, they can't get to the mic, give it to James. Like I said, the sponsor of this Skeptics Forum is Paradox Sunday School class that meets in this room at 11 o'clock on every Sunday morning. I want to invite you all to that class. I think it's the best Sunday school class in America. How's that for a provocative statement? Yes. We got one already. Wow. Okay. We also have treats back there, which I know is why you all came, right? For the food. There it is. All right. Our speaker tonight, speakers, but I'm going to introduce Dr. Hugh Ross first because he's always traditionally been the speaker at the Skeptics Forum. Dr. Ross is founder and president of Reasons to Believe. He is the author of 14, going on 100 books. He has a PhD in astronomy from the University of Toronto and a bachelor's in physics from the University of British Columbia. So I'm going to introduce Dr. Hugh Ross. Let's give him a big hand.
Yeah, this is a little different. In previous Skeptics Forums, you've only seen me up here. And these two gentlemen are here to assist. And Mark Perez has a master's degree in the philosophy and history of science. So if you've got philosophical questions, you can steer him his way. Ross has been the moderator of our Paradoxes class for quite some time and has been organizing these skeptics forums. And one reason why I appreciate Ross here is that some of you may not know I'm on the autistic spectrum, which allows me to integrate things that normal people have difficulty integrating, but it also means I'm very challenged in trying to read your emotions or trying to figure out what question you're asking. And so these gentlemen are here to help me discern exactly what question you're asking. I have a reputation for answering questions that you're really not asking. So they're there to help. And if you see us not quite hitting the mark, let us know. And we'll switch gears and try to get to the question you're actually asking. But there's another reason why we're doing this. It's our goal at Reasons to Believe that we have multiplied these skeptics forums across the country. And the biggest complaint I hear from people about launching one of these things is, I can't do it alone. Who says you have to do it alone? Get a group of friends who have expertise in different areas and you can do it as a group. So that's what we're going to try to model here. But literally, any question goes. Now, you've got two cards there. One card is designed to help you talk about these things with other people, take that home, but it's also a tear-off that you can fill out. And if you fill that out, you'll be included in a drawing for some cash-like prizes that we're going to give away in the second hour, namely books and DVDs. So if you want to be included in that drawing, you can fill that out. And the filling that out means that you'll be enrolled for free articles called Today's New Reason to Believe, where we talk about brand new scientific discoveries that pertain to faith issues. And so if you want that, you can fill it out and get that. And also, we'll cue you to get podcasts and videocasts. And so all that is free, but we need to know who you are in order for you to be able to get them. And you can get them sent to your computer or your smartphone, either way. So just let us know. Now,
there's also a 3x5 card.
There's a 3x5 card. What that's for is for those of you who've been to these skeptics forums before, let us know what you think about the new format, what you like about it, what you might like to see us adjust. And those of you that are brand new here, also we'd like to hear from you how you like the way we're organizing this or how you don't like the way we're organizing this. And we don't want your names, just your comments. So if you've got time throughout this next couple of hours, we'd like to hear your comments. Now, I always come prepared with a whole bunch of scientific discoveries that have been made in the last week, and we can talk about those discoveries and the impact they have on these science-based issues. But the rule is, if there's someone behind the mic, we don't talk about that, we talk about your issues. And I notice we already have somebody behind the mic. So we'll start taking questions, but if things slow down, there's no behind the mic, then we'll start talking about all these amazing discoveries. So, go for it.
I wrote it down so I wouldn't get all blubber-mouthed up here. I just started reading your book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is, and you quoted Stephen Hawking as saying, our solar system is certainly a prerequisite for our existence, but there does not seem to be any need for all those galaxies. You know that if that is still his view, and what is your view? And I'll probably find the answers in your book, but could you give us just a few reasons?
Right. You will find it in the book. And as far as where I think Stephen Hawking is today, frankly, I was quite surprised to see him make that statement in his book, The Grand Design. Well, it's possible it's coming from his co-author, Blood Now, at Caltech. So, and the reason why I'm surprised is that since Stephen Hawking has been famous for authoring some of the space-time theorems, I thought he must be aware that the mass of the universe is crucial for determining whether you even get planets in the first place. So if the universe is not massive enough, you won't get planets, but if it's too massive, you won't get planets either. And there's two reasons why the mass of the universe must be exquisitely fine-tuned. Reason number one, the mass of the universe determines what elements are fused during the first 4 minutes of the Big Bang creation event. Because the universe, when it comes into existence at a near infinitely hot temperature, but it's expanding. as it expands, it cools. Now, given that the whole universe is subject to the second law of thermodynamics, or what Romans 8 calls the law of decay, that means that anything that expands must get colder and colder as its system continues to expand. Which means in the expanding universe, there will be a window of time in which the universe is passing through nuclear fusion temperatures, roughly from, say, 150 billion degrees to about 17 billion degrees. Now, if the universe doesn't have sufficient mass, then the universe will expand so quickly through that temperature window of 17 billion to 150 billion degrees that very little of the hydrogen in the universe gets fused into helium. And if you only fuse a small amount of helium from hydrogen in that window, then stars that form will not be able to produce any elements besides helium. In other words, the universe would be nothing but hydrogen and helium throughout its entire history. And if all you've got is hydrogen and helium, you can't have planets and you can't have life. Life requires carbon, oxygen, nitrogen. On the other hand, if the universe has too much mass, the universe will spend such a long period of time in that temperature window that all the hydrogen gets fused into helium, or almost all of it gets fused into helium. And then when the stars form, they quickly fuse all the hydrogen and helium in the universe into elements heavier than iron. And once again, you've got a universe without carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, magnesium, etc. So the mass has to be very fine-tuned in order to have 25% of the hydrogen fused into helium, which is the precise mix you need in order to get the 98 elements that we enjoy in the crust of the Earth that makes life possible. The second reason why you want to fine-tune the expansion of the mass of the universe: the mass of the universe, as I've already outlined, governs the expansion rate of the universe. And if the universe expands too quickly from the cosmic creation event, gravity will not be able to collect the diffuse gas to make galaxies, stars, and planets. On the other hand, if the universe is too massive, then gravity will efficiently collect all that gas and compress it into nothing but black holes and neutron stars. And the universe is nothing but black holes and neutron stars. You can't have molecules, you can't have atoms, you can't even have protons. And again, life would be impossible. How fine-tuned must it be? It's necessary to fine-tune the total mass of the universe, or more accurately, the mass density of the universe, to better than one part in a quadrillion, 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 quadrillion. And so we really do need all those galaxies that are out there. So when our family celebrates Thanksgiving, we thank God for the 230 billion galaxies that are out there that makes it possible for us to enjoy our dinner.
Can I just add one more question? I know you mentioned that the universe is like the surface of a tent.
Yes.
That so as it's expanding, is it expanding like this, or is it going all directions?
Right. Well, there are two passages in the Bible where it says that God expands the universe like one would stretch out a tent from a backpack in order to live inside the tent. And the word picture there is that the reality of the tent is its surface, not its interior or its exterior. Likewise, Big Bang cosmology tells us that the reality of the universe is constrained to the three-dimensional surface of the four-dimensional expanding universe, where we're ignoring the six tiny space dimensions that accompany the three big ones. You know, a good analogy would be to think of planet Earth. Planet Earth is a globe, and it's three dimensions, but we human beings live on the two-dimensional surface of the three-dimensional Earth. The universe, all the stars and galaxies, and even all the space-time dimensionality is constrained to the three-dimensional surface of the four-dimensional expanding universe. And people often ask me, well, what's inside that surface? The answer is nothing. No space, no time. What's outside that surface? Again, nothing. No space, no time. you only have space and time on the cosmic surface of the universe. Now don't try to visualize it. It can't be done.
I've got a question from the audience. This is a good one. You, Mark, you can probably chime in on this one too. If you could get to the unlikely proposition that there is a supreme being, how do you get then to the proposition that the Bible, or Christianity for that matter, is the appropriate choice over the myriad of other human beliefs such as Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, Judaism, etc.?
Well, let me start off, because that's actually my story of how I became a Christian. Is it was through my astronomy I became persuaded the universe had a beginning, and hence a beginner. But I again began to check out the different holy books that made up the world's religions to see if any of them actually comported with what I was discovering in astronomy. And I began with Hinduism and realized that Hinduism teaches a reincarnating universe, a universe that has a beginning, grows from that beginning, and then collapses and has another beginning. And if you read the Hindu Vedas, the period between one beginning and the next reincarnation of the universe is 4.32 billion years. Well, the 4.32 is clearly wrong, but what's also clearly wrong is that the universe could actually undergo some mechanical bounce where it could go from one cycle to the next cycle. When I was a teenager checking this out, I recognized that the entropy level for the universe measures 100 million times too high for there to be any kind of mechanical rebound for the universe. Now, the Buddhist religions actually teach the same cosmology as Hinduism. Now, when it comes to Islam, Islam teaches, well, I'll actually give you three accounts of creation which contradict one another, but one of them talks about how the stars are closer to us than the planets. And even with the naked eye, you can tell that the planets are much closer to us than the stars, because with the naked eye, we can see parallax on the planets, but we can't on the stars. And that's how the ancient Greeks discerned that the stars must be bodies like the sun, because they tried to measure the parallax and couldn't, and concluded they had to be at great distances. So, and then, you know, I began to look at the Baha'i. It talks about different aspects of the universe that they collect from all the different world religions. Baha'i is kind of an eclectic faith. Mormonism talks about how there's a master planet at the center of our galaxy. At the center of our galaxy is a black hole that comes in at about, 3 million solar masses, and would irradiate everything within the vicinity of the center of the galaxy and make life impossible. And he also noted that the Mormon scriptures talk about how this master planet Kolob, from which all life first came, has a rotation period of 1,000 days. And that again is something that would rule out the possibility of life. It'd be way too cold at night and too hot in the daytime. And I finally did pick up a Bible. And when I picked up a Bible, it was the only holy book that I found that was consistent with Big Bang cosmology. In fact, what impressed me was that it actually predicted all the fundamental characteristics of Big Bang cosmology at least 2,000 years before any human being even had an inkling that we live in a universe with a space-time beginning, where that the universe expands from that space-time beginning under constant laws of physics, where one of those laws is a pervasive law of decay. And so that was a major factor in my coming to faith in Christ. And that's something we talk about at Reasons to Believe, that we see the scientific evidence not only strong enough to establish the existence of God, but to identify which of all the different gods that are out there is the one that's actually responsible for bringing us into existence. But, Mark?
Now, this is a good question, because what it does is it forces us to ask the question, is there evidence other than just a bare belief? And Hugh gave some evidence as to why he selected Christianity over some other religions. And this really does force the question, is Christianity a religion that is based strictly on a belief system? Or is it a religion based on empiricism? Is there some empirical evidence to suggest that Christianity is not only true, but superior to any other religion? It also suggests the question, if Christianity is an empirical religion or empirical belief, and atheism is a contrary belief, is there some reason why we should not accept atheism and we should accept Christianity? And again, we get back to the question, is it empirical? Can you say that Christianity is the most superior of all the choices, atheism, other religions, or no religion at all? And the answer is yes. And the way we do this scientifically is we say, look at all these different options as theories or hypotheses, whatever way you want to explain. And given these different hypotheses, which of these models best fits the evidence? And when you look at Christianity, there are all sorts of reasons why Christianity would be the best model, because it has the best fit, the correspondence between its theories and reality. And the reason I wanted to get into this, at least just to this degree, was to explain that a lot of folks believe that Christianity is just another thought. Yet they ask, well, why should I believe one over the other? Well, because there's actually physical evidence. There's also non-physical evidence. But the point is that when we look at, say, something like evolution as a theory that would explain the origin of man, for example, and we look at divine creation as an explanation for the origin of man, are those two just merely different beliefs? Or is there physical evidence that can make one a better competitor than the other? The reasons to believe testable creation model says if we make certain predictions based on the evidence, then we should expect something to come out of our predictions that would not occur under the evolutionary model, or an atheistic model, or an Islamic model, or any other model. And so I'll leave it at this, without going into all the depth of all of the different kinds of evidences there are, that when you deal with religious questions, or deal with the question, am I going to even have a religion, or is this the best religion, ask yourself, what is the evidence, and what are the other models, and which one best fits the evidence? And I think that's where this question really, really is great, because it forces us to start asking those questions.
One analogy I like to use when people say, well, how can you pick one religion over any other religion? Aren't they all the same? Aren't they all an equal path to God? I say, well, is any food you eat equally healthy for your body? There's a lot of food that if we eat it, we feel awful. We die sooner. We don't like it. It doesn't taste good. There's other food that is nourishing to us in many ways. So why would a search for God be different than that? I see it that way. And it's a good analogy. I've used it with people, and they understand that. Jim?
Hugh, I have a question. I love your, when you bring up 50 billion trillion stars in the universe, but I need to relate it to a dime. How many, if you were to fill the Pasadena Rose Bowl with dimes up to the brim, how many Rose Bowls would equal that amount? I'm not, approximately.
A lot.
Well, we actually took on your challenge in why the universe is the way it is. And you would need dimes twice as high as the Sears Tower, packed as tightly as possible, covering the entire continent of South America, to get up to that number of 50 billion trillion.
Wow.
And every one of those stars is necessary for you to be at that microphone.
Thank you.
Aside from the creation of Adam and Eve, is it possible that God purposefully regulated and sped up the natural processes of creating new species from existing species? Sounds like theistic evolution.
Well, let me take a stab at it, Ross, and then whoever asks the question can correct us. It says in Genesis 1 that God creates for 6 days and rests on the seventh day. And you notice there's no evening and morning for the seventh day in Genesis 1. We're still in the seventh day. There are three other passages in the Bible, Psalm 95, John 5, and Hebrews 11, that speak about the ongoing nature of God's seventh day. The seventh day is when God stops creating and targets the problem of evil. His goal is to remove evil and suffering during the seventh day. But the fact that he ceases from his work of creating means that when we do science in the present era, all we're going to see is natural process. And I think that's one reason why I, as an astronomer, had an easier time coming to the Christian faith. Number one, I didn't get exposed to church. I didn't really run into church until I came to the United States. Number two is that in astronomy, our data comes from the past. It takes light time to travel from stars and galaxies to get to our telescope. So in astronomy, most of our data is coming from the 6 days, not from the seventh day. I think that explains why so many astronomers believe in God and so few biologists believe in God. Most biologists focus their research in the present era. And so when you read their literature, they'll say, we see no evidence for the handiwork of God. Well, they're looking on the wrong day. Now, with respect to this question, we see a very low rate of speciation in the present era. We see a little bit at the plant level, but the difference between plant species is much, much smaller than it is between animal species. So, for example, in the entire human era, we've not been able to document the appearance of a single mammal species. But if you look previous to the human era, the speciation rate was very aggressive, averaging at least one new species appearing every single year. That was the state of affairs from the origin of life 3.8 billion years ago all the way up to the appearance of human beings. With human beings, the speciation rate drops catastrophically. And then, as I said, for mammals it measures zero, for birds it measures a handful. And there again it's debatable, because when they talk about bird speciation, it's basically a single species of birds where part of the members of that species become geographically separated. And then those that are geographically separated in time will refuse to mate with those from which they've been separated. But it's actually possible to reverse the process and make one species. And that, for example, has been demonstrated with a number of bird species that, quote, the speciation event is simply an artifact of the geographical separation. You're really not making distinctly different birds. But, you know, for 6 days God creates, on the seventh day rest, explains the dramatic dichotomy between speciation today and speciation in the past. In fact, we're arguing that reasons to believe this is something that can put different creation evolution models to the test, because you can do what are called long-term evolution experiments, where you raise bacteria or yeast in the lab and raise them under the conditions that forces the most aggressive evolutionary change. And if that rate of evolutionary change that you see, or the degree of evolutionary change, is not adequate to explain what you've seen before the human era, then you know that the naturalistic model has come up short. And there's actually been 3 long-term evolution experiments that have demonstrated that very thing. I commend the researchers, because they really didn't get any results until 20 years had gone by. That's a long time to go without publishing a paper. But now these experiments have been run long enough where they're getting significant results, and it's having a profound effect on the biological evolutionary community.
Jim?
Yeah, it's related to the topic you were just discussing about the origin of humans. And one thing I was wondering about is, according to the evolutionary hypothesis, you know, that we evolved from some hominid that we don't really know what it would have been, that, you know, and then there was this bottleneck where you had very, very few humans, modern humans, that it collapsed and almost went extinct and then somehow escaped that. The question I had is that if we have genetic damage occurring, this is just a normal, any species that has not had genetic damage building up over time, how do they address that aspect? Because if we're talking about humans having evolved from a previously existing hominid that had been there for hundreds of thousands or maybe millions of years, it would have already had a huge amount of genetic damage building up in its genome. And if that's reduced down to this, you know, very, very small population, that's extinction, isn't it? Do they deal with that aspect of it too? Or, cause, you know, if we have a pristine genome to start with, then we don't have to worry about that. Well, that's creation.
So you're raising an excellent test that's actually being executed right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that if the biblical model of human origins is correct, we would anticipate to have very little decay in the human genome. Because after all, from a biblical perspective, humans have only been around for a few tens of thousands of years. And that's not enough time to accumulate much genetic decay. But from an evolutionary perspective, if we're the product of a common descent from bacteria all the way up to, the Cambrian explosion animals, and then primates, and then hominids, and then finally human beings, then we should have the most decay of any species on the planet. And so this has been an object of test, to look at the genome and say, do we see evidence for a huge amount of genetic decay in the human genome? Or do we see that the human genome is relatively pristine? And for a long time, geneticists were convinced that the evolutionary model had to be correct because we could only identify 2% functionality in the human genome. 98%, we couldn't identify any functionality at all, and they presumed that that 98% was the genetic decay from common descent. Now that's all changed literally in the past few weeks, where something called the ENCODE project has documented that at least 80% of the human genome has functionality. And if you look at the articles we've been writing on a Reasons to Believe website, we're pointing out the scientific literature that documents that most of the remaining 20% also has functionality. And the point here is, just because you can't understand the function doesn't mean that there is no function. And what happened historically is that when they said only 2% has function, the only function they were looking for was whether or not a portion of the genome actually contained the blueprint that described how proteins were to be manufactured. And they presumed that that's all the genome served to do. We now know that the vast majority of a human genome actually regulates the development of the individual from the time of conception until, in the case of males, when they reach 25 years of age. Women is 22, but men take 3 years longer to fully mature. And most of our genome is basically regulations, parts of the genes that actually regulate the development of the human being. And also something else we're discovering is that the way an individual lives during those first 25 years actually can affect the DNA in the gametes. And so that's a very interesting piece of research, is that the presumption amongst genomics, people studying genomics, is that it's 100% nature, 0% nurture. Evidence is now indicating that that assumption is incorrect, that there's actually changes that take place in the human genome as a direct result of how individuals behave and live out their existence during the developmental years. And that's research is still ongoing. But it's a wonderful way to put to the test the competing models. From a biblical perspective, there should be very little junk in the human genome. But the question is, do we really understand all the purposes that the human genome serves?
Hugh, do you see hints in the Bible about what you just said about how behavior could affect the genome?
Well, there's passages in the books of Moses that makes the point that the righteousness of the parents gets passed on to the children to the third and fourth generation, and the sin of the parents gets passed on to the children to the third and fourth generation. And psychologically, we can understand that. I mean, the way I as a parent, relate to my sons is going to affect how they develop. But it's possible that it's more than just a psychological issue. There may actually be a physiological impact that we're still trying to research. So I think genomics is a very exciting discipline for putting to the test competing creation evolution models, but also putting to the test for understanding of certain passages of the Bible.
James, do you have a question? Oh, did you ask this one?
Yeah.
It's not silly. I was going to ask it next, so here you go. If I don't ask it, are you going to stick around? Oh, okay. Well, then I'll ask it. Do dogs and cats go to heaven, and will I see my cat again who died?
Well, it's that question that's gotten me into more trouble than any other question I've ever had to answer. Well, okay. We do actually have a book on that topic called Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. Because it's the Book of Job that really addresses the role that the higher animals play. And the Bible refers to these higher animals as nephesh creatures, loosely translated soulish animals. These are the animals that God endows with mind, will, and emotions so that they can relate to one another. These are the animals that nurture and care for their young. So insects aren't in that category, fish aren't in that category, but birds and mammals are. And a few of the higher reptiles would be in that category. But the other way that the Bible defines them is that it's those animal species that are capable of bonding to human beings, developing an emotional bond with human beings, and serving and pleasing human beings. So any animal that we can tame to serve and please us would be a nephesh animal. And it was God's intent that we would bond to these lower animals. And it was Job that said, look to the beasts, referring to the land mammals, they will teach you. Look to the birds, they'll instruct you. And his point was, they'll teach you and instruct you about God. And how they do that is that we can see how powerfully motivated they are to serve and please us, a higher being. Likewise, we human beings have been created to serve a higher being. So they were created to serve a higher species, we are created to serve a higher being. God created us to serve and please Him. Now, that doesn't always happen. Moreover, we look at these animals and often they run away from us and instead of towards us. And that's kind of lesson number two. Because of human sin, we abuse these creatures and instead of serving and pleasing us, they run away from us. Well, likewise, it's our sin that causes us to run away from God, pretend that He doesn't exist, because it separates us from our Creator. And also, at the very end of the book of Job, God steps in and says to Job and his friends, you've been able to tame all these animals. You've even been able to tame the Leviathan and the Behemoth, the two most difficult to tame of all the nephesh animals. But he says there's one species you can't tame. You cannot tame a proud human being. It takes me, a higher being, to bring humility to a proud human being. And so the book of Job ends with the point that the only way we can be delivered from the sin within us is to come to God for the humility that we need, because we're not going to be able to drum it up on ourselves. So that's kind of step one to coming into a relationship with our Creator. And the thing I've noticed, I mean, I've traveled all over the world and I've debated atheists all over the world, but I only find atheists in cities. I don't find them in the countryside. Where people have contact with these birds and mammals, they recognize that God must exist. And so, and what's happening in the cities? People get cut off from contact with these animals. So it was God's intent that we would form relationships with these animals. It was also His intent that those emotional bonds would be very strong. And so, you know, we have dogs and cats in our home, and they're very powerfully bonded to us. I mean, I got a cat that's so strongly bonded to me that when I go into town, I got to talk to him over the phone to get him to calm down. He starts throwing tantrums once I get on that airplane. So, and my wife will say, you got to talk to your cat. So, and what's amazing is the cat recognizes my voice over the phone and immediately becomes calm. So, but God intended that those bonds would be very strong. He also intended that we would grieve deeply when we lose that bond with our pet. And so when our pets die, we go through a grieving process. And matter of fact, if you were to die with a pet, the pet would grieve. And so we see that there's a grief on both sides. Well, likewise, God grieves when we walk away from Him. So in one sense, these animals are an important part of our lives, in that when that bond is broken, we get an idea of how God feels when we break our relationship with Him and run away. Now, to answer your question, are there going to be dogs in heaven? Cats?
She doesn't care about the dogs.
She doesn't care about the dogs. Just wants to know the cats are going to be there. Well, for me, I want to know if my Pedro, my parrot's going to be there. But the point is, what you see in Genesis 1, and in much more detail in the book of Job, God creates three different kinds of life. Life that's purely physical, life that's physical and soulish, and one and only one species that's body, soul, and spirit. And what God creates that is spiritual is eternal. So the angels live forever. Human beings live forever. And the difference between us and the animals, one difference is how we respond to death. You know, when you look at the animals, they're not even aware that they're going to die. They're not asking philosophical questions. What's going to happen to me when I die? They have no concern over that. And when they face death, it's not the trauma that it is for us human beings. As it tells us in John 16, every human being knows that judgment comes after this life is over. We may run away from that truth, but it's gnawing away at every human being. We kind of know that that's there. But you don't see that in the animals. There's not even a hint of that in the animals. As it says in the book of Ecclesiastes, when a dog or a cat dies, it returns to the dust. So, and you read on in Ecclesiastes, it makes the point that only humans and angels will enter the new creation. Now, caveat to that, what you'll see in the book of Revelation is that when we enter into the new creation, God creates again. He's going to be creating kingdoms. That's all you're going to see there in the book of Revelation. But what that tells me is it's quite possible that God will be creating new species of life in the new creation. And the principle is this, throughout the entire Bible, God never takes anything away from you without giving you something better in return. The cat that you have a relationship with right now may not be with you in heaven, but something far better will be with you in heaven. So my theology is that, yes, we form these powerful bonds with these nephesh animals, but they're not like us. They're not eternal. Only human beings and angels, out of all of God's created creatures, are eternal. And we're eternal whether we like it or not. People say, well, why doesn't God just snuff us out? No, there's a spiritual law that God has set up. Whatever is spiritual is eternal. Whatever is not a spiritual is temporal.
Mark, do you want to say anything about that?
No.
Okay.
now
we know why Hugh always takes like 8 minutes to answer that question. James.
Biblically and or scientifically, how old is planet Earth and the universe, the heavens? And from Genesis to Revelation, what's the timeline on that, and how much of a time difference is there between each book, Old and New Testament?
Well, in terms of the chronology of the Bible, you've got four chronologies. Chronology number one would be the historical books. That's Genesis, and it goes right up through 2 Chronicles. And those books are in chronological order. And then what follows are the poetic books, beginning with Job. And those poetic books ending up in the Song of Solomon are also in chronological order. But the chronology of the wisdom books does not follow the chronology of the historical books. So, for example, I'm persuaded that Job is the oldest book of the Bible, not Genesis. It's the first of the poetic books, and it actually predates the first of the historical books. And following that, you have what are called the prophets, beginning with Isaiah and going all the way to Malachi. Those two are in a chronological order. So Isaiah is the first, Malachi is the last. But again, we shouldn't be looking at this being something that follows after the poetic books or after the historical books, although it turns out that the prophetic books really are after both those books. And then you got the New Testament. And that's a chronology that follows after the three sets of Old Testament books. So yeah, you've got four sets of books in the Bible in chronological order, but they don't necessarily chronologically follow one after the other. And you want to know what about the age of the earth and the age of the universe? The best date we have for the age of the universe is 13.75 billion, plus or minus 0.11 billion. And there's efforts going on right now to get an answer to that question that's accurate to four or five places of decimal rather than just three and a half places. Age of the Earth, much more precisely known, 4.5662 billion, plus or minus 0.0001 billion. So that's known quite accurately.
Dinosaurs lived billions of years of age ago? Is that correct?
Dinosaurs were from about 250 million years ago to 65 million years ago. Cambrian explosion, 543 million years ago. So in terms of what you see in Genesis, creation day 5, either starts with the Cambrian explosion or the Avalon explosion. Avalon is 575 million years ago. But I was talking about the beginning of animal life, and that's when that dates.
Go ahead.
I have a question that I've heard the famous late British atheist Christopher Hitchin, when he would bait people, he would say put this challenge to a lot of his debaters about Homo sapiens appearing on the earth for the first time 100,000 years ago. And that God, well, if man, made in God's image, appeared 100,000 years ago, why would this loving God remain silent in terms of reaching out to his creation, his created image, for so many thousands of years, and then starting with, really, Noah, and then Abraham? You know, there's a big gap. Why was God silent? I don't know how to answer that, because that's a really good challenge in my mind.
Well, here's a couple of responses. That 100,000-year date, scientific date for the first humans, is based on thermoluminescence or optical luminescence, and those dates are notoriously inaccurate. So when you read the scientific literature, see what dating method they're using. And with the first humans, all they got are these luminescence methods. And
How old is the first human?
I'm comfortable with several tens of thousands of years. If you told me it was 100,000 years ago, I'm okay with that.
Okay.
I'd be very reluctant to take a date any earlier than about 40,000 years ago. And that's because of the description in the Bible that the Garden of Eden was a place where the Tigris, the Euphrates, the Gihon, and the Pishon came together. And that they don't come together today. They only came together during the last ice age, when most of the Persian Gulf was dry. So I would argue for a fairly early date for Noah.
Okay.
I think a rough date for Noah would be, say, 40,000 years ago, give or take 20 or 30,000 years.
Okay.
And you say, boy, that's not very accurate. But the dates aren't that accurate.
Right.
You can get a rough idea from the Bible by calibrating the Genesis 5 and 11 genealogies. But the calibration is based on a radiocarbon date for Peleg. Genesis 10:25, the world was divided in the days of Peleg, which I think is probably a reference to the breaking of the great land bridges. And that's been dated to about 11,000 to 11,500 years ago. And of course, we got a good historical date for Abraham, namely 4,000 years ago. And so, with those two dates, and given the declining lifespans you see in Genesis 11, that crudely gives you a date for Noah about 40,000 years ago, and from Adam and Eve in the neighborhood of 60 to 70,000 years ago. And those dates are roughly consistent with what are called the cultural Big Bangs. And there we got a lot of luminescence data that establishes that clothing explosively appeared roughly 50,000 years ago. Likewise, advanced tools, jewelry, art, religious expression. but you say, you know, why didn't God put things in writing earlier? We didn't have written language until about 4,000 years ago. Hebrew didn't exist as a written language until 3,500 years ago. I think Genesis is the first written book of the Bible, but I believe that Job is the oldest book of the Bible because of the way it is established. It's poetry. And if you look at it in the original Hebrew, it's poetry that's designed to be easily memorized. So I think the book of Job was preserved through people memorizing it word for word until Hebrew became a written language. But was God communicating to Adam and Eve? Genesis says so. Was God communicating to Noah? Genesis says so. It was verbal communication. It wasn't written communication. So the fact that Hitchens says no written documents until 4,000 years ago, well, of course, we didn't have written language until 4,000 years ago.
Good. Thank you.
Mark, did you want to say anything on that?
That's good.
Okay, this is a kind of an interesting question. It's a little off beat, but I'll ask it. On February 1st, Israel signed an agreement with the Vatican to control the holy sites in Jerusalem. And at the current time, there is a negotiation between the Palestinians and Israel regarding East Jerusalem to return to build the third temple. Do you know what do you think will happen with the Dome of the Rock?
Well, the place to go for that is the book of Ezekiel. The book of Ezekiel is filled with prophecies about the rebirth of Israel as a modern-day nation. And actually, you can piece together predictions in the Bible about the wars that Israel would fight. That's amazing, the detail that's there. But it makes the point that this temple will not be built. It does say a third temple will be built in Jerusalem, but it will not be built until Israel is in control of the ancient territories of Ammon, Moab, and Edom. And right now they're not. In fact, what Ezekiel points out is they will not possess those territories, but they will politically control them. So something, according to Ezekiel, is going to take place where Israel gains control of those territories. And that may be the solution to the Palestinian problem, namely that the Jews would occupy the land of Canaan, and the Palestinians would occupy the ancient territories of Ammon, Moab, and Edom. Say, what are those ancient territories? Well, right after World War I, Winston Churchill boasted that he created the nation of Transjordan with a stroke of a pen. Actually, he created a little map of what that would be. If you look at the nation of Jordan, it perfectly encompasses the ancient territories of Ammon, Moab, and Edom, no more, no less. So I kind of look at what Ezekiel was saying. Events are going to take place where the Israelis will gain control over Jordan and say to the Palestinians, that's your state, and what's on the west side of the Jordan River will be our state. That hasn't happened yet. So I don't think this third temple is going to be built next year. Moreover, Ezekiel makes the point that the temple will not be built until Israel is without visible arms. So as long as they got tanks and airplanes, it can't happen, according to the book of Ezekiel. Also, it prophesies that it won't happen until Israel becomes the richest nation on the planet on a per capita basis. They're getting close, but they're not there yet. I think what tells me it's getting close, what I find interesting, is that of all the companies that are part of the NASDAQ grouping, most of the companies are American, but the nation has the second greatest number of NASDAQ companies is Israel. And on a per capita basis, they're way ahead of any other nation in the world. They have the largest number of physicists per capita, largest number of computer programmers per capita. And so that may lead them to be indeed becoming the richest nation on a per capita basis. But the whole point is, none of these prophecies have been fulfilled. The prophecies of the valleys of dry bones have been fulfilled. That was something that was significant in my becoming a Christian, is reading Ezekiel 37. And it says that the nations of the world will declare that there will be no new nation Israel. But when the valleys of dry bones are exposed, and the Gentile nations see these enormous valleys filled with the skeletons of your people, they will declare, Zionism will never happen. There will be no nation. When they say that, that's the year in which the nation will be born. And indeed, that's exactly what happened back in 47 and 48. Newspapers display these photographs of these huge valleys filled with the dry bones of Jews killed during the Holocaust. And that's when you saw a newspaper headline saying, Zionism is done. There will be no new nation Israel. And within months, there was a nation Israel. So, read the book of Ezekiel. It's fascinating stuff. It's about 200 predictions of what will happen to the modern nation of Israel, most of which have already been fulfilled. And for people as old as I am, fulfilled in our lifetime.
You two gentlemen back there, keep your place in line. It's 8 o'clock. The coffee's here. We're going to take a break. Everybody, we want to get started again. Before we ask the next question, I forgot to mention that there's a book table over here that has many of Dr. Ross's books, some other reasons to believe material. Please feel free to go over there and take a look at it, and you can purchase it for a nominal sum. It's very exciting material. All right, let's take the next question.
Oh, yes, Dr. Ross, I love you and your ministry and all your assistance and everything. I hope I won't offend anybody, but I was discussing with someone in the ministry yesterday about whether the atheists and evolutionists, when they're faced with the question, did George Washington and Thomas Jefferson call on the name of God, they always fall back and say they were deists or theists or something. And I don't mind that when I'm not surprised when they say that, but when I hear a believing Christian say that, I get pretty upset because I've studied history for 40 years, and I would like some time to counter-argue because I think I know what will be said. But for instance, George Washington served as the chaplain for the British Army during the French and Indian Wars every Sunday, and he served as a chaplain in the Continental Army when there was no chaplain available on Sundays. And David Barton, who has his own ministry on Trinity Broadcasting Network, he owns more original manuscripts that were owned by the Founding Fathers than anybody in the world. And he said Thomas Jefferson came to church every Sunday in the 8 years of his administration, which was held in the Capitol building for the first several decades, and they had a special chair for the presidents to come. And as far as if you could explain deism, what I know about deism is God, maybe he had to create the world, but then he started the time clock. And then he took no more interest in what happened to any of his creation. He went off and he fell asleep, sort of like a Rip Van Winkle.
Yeah,
God.
What's your question?
You know, I do not think that the Founding Fathers, I deny they were deists. I believe they believed in Jesus Christ, that he and God answers our prayers.
No, I understand that, but what is your question?
Well, I think someone told me that the Founding Fathers, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, were deists in this ministry.
Is your question, were they deists?
Yeah. And I deny if someone says they were, you know, why did George Washington declare Thanksgiving was a national holiday?
Well, let's go with that. You want to tackle that?
Well, there's good evidence that George Washington was sincere in his belief in the Bible. The reason why Jefferson often gets paid as being a deist, because as he went through the New Testament, he kind of edited out all the miracles. So they're saying, well, he must have not believed that there was miracles. The only evidence we have is that he was denying the New Testament miracles. How he felt about the Old Testament miracles is speculation. And, you know, there are different definitions of deism. But typically when somebody says deist, they mean God exists, God creates the universe, God's responsible for the math and the physics, the laws of physics, but having created the universe, he lets the natural processes do everything else. He doesn't intervene beyond creating the universe. So that would be what I would call a hard deist. But there's also soft deists that believe that God does actually intervene, but intervene in a way that we can't possibly detect.
Well, then why should we pray? Why should we come to Reasons to Believe?
Well, keep in mind, we're not deists. That's not our position.
I thought I heard that. I'm sorry, it got me all upset.
My understanding is that some of them were deists and some of them would have been considered evangelical Christians in the way that we think about it. There was a wide range of beliefs, just like there would be now in any group of believers. The amazing thing about that period is that so many of the values from the Bible, the values that are Christian values, wound up in our political thought and in our Constitution and in the Declaration of Independence.
Yes, okay, and I know there was a lot of miracles that happened when General Cornwallis was trying to escape from Yorktown. The wind came up and he couldn't escape. He had to come back. George Washington, it's witnessed, he was shot 4 holes in his uniform coat. It would have had to go through his body in the French and Indian War. His officers observed it, but he was never wounded. And the Indian chief told his lawyers, they were shooting at him for 30 minutes. I finally told them, don't shoot at him anymore. The Great Spirit is protecting him. Mm-hmm. And Winston Churchill said, a convoy of reinforcements in his 4-volume History of the English-Speaking Peoples was coming with reinforcements, men, ammunition, food, and it was destroyed by a storm at sea. So anyway, thank you for letting me get that out.
Okay. Go ahead.
This gentleman asked a question, why was God silent over some long period of time? And that got me thinking, why is God silent today? If God is a loving God, and if God is still in our lives, why does He let us suffer? Why do we suffer? Now you could say, well, it's our fault, we're sinners. But why doesn't God intervene? And it seems cruel for a loving God who's all powerful to watch us suffer.
Unless the suffering serves a higher purpose.
And maybe we just don't understand it.
Well, I think we do. That's been a lot of the writing that we've done at Reasons to Believe is try to address the question of why is there evil and suffering. Well, let me address the first question you raised. Is God silent? He is silent according to the Bible with respect to creation activity. During the seventh day, He ceases to intervene in any miraculous way in the arena of the natural realm. So in that sense, as we do science today, all we anticipate to discover is natural process. But it doesn't mean God is silent. This is something that Jesus addressed in His ministry. He said, my Father and I are at rest, but He performed miracles in the Sabbath to make the point that He's resting from some things, but focusing on other things. And so what He said to the Jewish leaders, you feed your children on the Sabbath. What you do in the Sabbath is you stop your normal employment. That's what God has done. He has stopped His employment of creation activity, but now on the Sabbath, He's working to end all evil and suffering. Yes, there is evil and suffering, but the evil and suffering is something planned and directed by God to bring about a higher good. And earlier I was talking about how I looked at the different religions of the world. What I noticed about those religions, except for the Bible, they all talk a one creation model, where God creates the universe and then fulfills human destiny in that universe. What I saw different in the Bible is God creates the universe as a tool in His hand to eliminate all evil and suffering. And when evil and suffering are ended, then the universe, having fulfilled its divine purpose, gets removed by God and replaced by a brand new realm with different laws of physics, even different dimensions that won't be the space-time dimensions we experience now. And that got me to thinking, is it possible that the space-time dimensions are actually designed to deal with the problem of evil? Is it possible that the laws of physics are designed to deal with the problem of evil? And that's kind of the heart of what I wrote in Why the Universe is the Way It Is, that every one of the laws of physics, every one of the space-time dimensions, has been optimally designed to eliminate evil and suffering as quickly and efficiently as possible. And you told me before we got going that you are a professor at Caltech. And, you know, I was on the faculty at Caltech. And, you know, one thing I've learned as a professor, my role as a professor is to make my students suffer. That's my job. Well, to make the point, I've had students complain because they said my course teaching wasn't difficult enough. In other words, they were complaining because I wasn't making them suffer sufficiently. That's typical of the good students. The good students want more suffering. The poor students want less suffering. Now, let me finish this, because the reason why my students pay money to suffer at my hand is because they know the suffering is brief. They only have to put up with me for a semester. Moreover, they know that if they suffer at my hand for a semester, it will have the benefit of preparing them for a career that might last 40 or 50 years. And they have such high value in that career that they're more than willing to pay good money to suffer at my hand. Well, likewise, from a biblical perspective, our suffering is brief. And it's our brief exposure to suffering that prepares us for future careers in the new creation. And, you know, nobody gets to the new creation without being tested. So that's another part of the analogy. You can't pass my classes without going through a test. Well, neither do you get to go to the new creation without going through a test. And one of the stories I tell in the book is that, you know, if you go to my office, thanks to my wife, there's a piece of parchment there that's framed that says PhD on it. And what that piece of parchment really means is it guarantees that never again will I have to be tested for my competency in astronomy. And it's based on the myth that my professors at the University of Toronto subjected me to the most difficult test. Therefore, it's pointless to test me again. Well, the amazing thing about the biblical approach to evil and suffering, God chooses to expose humanity to the most difficult tests. Of all the creatures God created, Satan is the most powerful. And God chose to invite Satan into the Garden of Eden to test Adam and Eve. The benefit of that is they were being subjected to the most difficult tests. Now, something else that I tell in the book is how when I entered the University of Toronto, there were 13 of us in the freshman graduate class. Our professor sat us down and said, "This is the best university in Canada, and you students are the cream of the crop. And we know you're brilliant, we know you're prepared to work hard, but we guarantee you will not pass and get your PhD unless you receive help from us. We're here to help you, but you're not going to make it without our help." The Bible's message is the same. God is subjecting us to the most difficult test, but He's compassionate. He wants to help us pass that most difficult test. And we take His help, we will pass. And if we pass, never again will we ever be tempted by sin, evil, and therefore the pain, the suffering, the death can be eternally removed.
Satan tempted Adam and Eve with the tree of knowledge.
Right.
And that rubs me the wrong way as an educator, because I believe in the tree of knowledge. I believe Caltech's motto is, "The truth shall make you free."
Yeah, and they're quoting from John 8.
Well, that's okay.
Yeah.
Still, I have trouble. How do you reconcile the tree of knowledge being the origin of our downfall?
Yeah, I've had that discussion with my sons and said, you know, as your father, I want to instruct you about the knowledge of good and evil rather than having you experience it firsthand. God was in the same position. His desire was to instruct, to educate Adam and Eve about these things. Where they fell is they chose to experience evil firsthand. God's desire was that they would be taught about it. Instead, they experienced it firsthand and suffered the consequences. Now, having experienced it firsthand, God blessed them with the gift of physical death. See, God created two different intelligent species, angels and human beings. And when the angels rebelled against God, there was no possibility of redemption. Humans, on the other hand, when they rebelled against God, had a pathway to redemption because God chose to take away the tree of life. and it's through the tool of physical death we can be delivered from the far worse consequences of spiritual death. So, for example, well, let me give you an example here. The fact that we can die physically means that you don't have the prospect of an evil serial killer killing off the rest of the human species. Eventually, that serial killer dies, and so it prevents the spread of evil. And this is why you see the lifespans being shortened in the book of Genesis. Long lifespans are a prescription for uncontrolled evil. Short lifespans are a blessing. And however, we need to live at least a few decades to establish our virtue before God as we receive His help. So you don't want to live long enough for that to work, but if you live too long, then the advantage tilts towards the ones who choose to follow the path of evil. So, and I also argue that the space-time dimensions God put us in are designed to encourage virtue and to limit evil. And I think the answer to that is, once evil is conquered and permanently removed, we're no longer constrained by length, width, height, and time. God is going to deliver us into geometric time and to new space dimensions, whereby we'll be able to experience relationships at a far more intimate level than are possible now. Why does God not give us that now? If He did, evil would run amok completely unchecked. And so God is actually using things like thermodynamics, gravity, electromagnetism, the space-time dimensions, as tools whereby we have the best possible opportunity to enter the new creation. But hey, if you want to read more about it, we got two books over there, Why the Universe is the Way It Is and Beyond the Cosmos.
Thank you.
I'd like to address the evil and suffering question. I can speak very personally. There's a quote that I just recently heard by a Christian author named A.W. Tozer, and it really slapped me across the face when I heard it. He said, "God cannot do anything with us until He wounds us first." And I know from my own life that that's true. It's the hardest times that taught me the most, that taught me to be humble, that taught me that God's in charge. And it's an indication of the human condition that that's what it takes for us to learn, that evil and suffering is a necessary part of us really getting anywhere. And it does seem like there's even more evil and suffering in the world than is necessary for that. But there are reasons for that too. I do think, though, it's probably the most difficult, challenging question to the Christian faith. If there is a loving God, why is there evil and suffering? But I also think there are good answers to it.
So, as part of my understanding of what are some of the forethoughts of science right now, as well as philosophy, is that they're trying to really make a distinction about what the conscious mind is, separated from the physical aspect of just neuron firings and things like that. Is there any reason to believe that we will have an integrated view of what the biological and the consciousness that we have, that we'll get a good picture of that through science? Or is that more of a spirituality, soul kind of characteristic of how we perceive the world that we live in?
Well, experiments are started on that very question about 3 years ago. That's another reason why I wrote Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, is to talk about experiments that are dealing with consciousness and comparing the consciousness of the higher animals with the consciousness of human beings. And it was Charles Darwin who said that the human mind is simply the product of common descent, and that as we got our physical characteristics from the lower animals, we got our characteristics of the mind from the lower animals, and therefore was predicting that in terms of the operation of our mind, we'd be most akin to orangutans and chimpanzees. And nobody bothered to put that to the test until 3 years ago. And it was a group of researchers at UCLA that decided to do experiments on animals to see which species were most akin in terms of the operation of their mind to human beings. And it turns out that the orangutan and the chimpanzee did not score that well. There were other species, especially bird species, that scored much higher. and the one that scored the highest of all was the raven. The raven is an animal, unlike chimpanzees and orangutans, that without any training by human beings can take a tool and use that tool to recover a completely different kind of tool and use that tool to get food. Whereas the orangutan and chimpanzee, the best they can do is get a tool and use that to get food. And also they noted that when ravens are emotionally bonded to human beings, they show far more intelligence than when they're not. And one of the things that we now are discovering about ravens, they love to show off to human beings how smart they are. Chimpanzees do that to a certain degree, but ravens really love to do that. So, for example, they can solve very complex puzzles if they're being observed by human beings. If nobody's watching them, they don't bother. If they're being watched, they can do that. But there is another set of experiments done by researchers at UC San Diego where they noted that if you compare animals to human beings, it was Charles Darwin who said, you'll see a continuity, but they documented that there's an enormous discontinuity when it comes to symbol recognition. That no matter how much you train animals, you cannot train them to read. They can't even read the Dick and Jane books that we give to 5-year-olds. And they can't respond to a stop sign. So even the simplest road signs that we have that have no letters on them, they cannot figure out what they mean. And so symbol recognition is something that's unique to human beings. And it was the start of a number of papers published by the same UC San Diego group that just said there's an enormous mental discontinuity between human beings and all other animals. There is no Darwinian continuity that exists there. And something else you'll see in the book is that according to the Darwinian model, horses and donkeys are very closely related. They are in terms of their physical morphology, but in terms of the way they use their minds to serve and please human beings, you couldn't find two animals that are more different. So the Darwinian model would predict that the mindful characteristics would also be similar, and the truth is they're not. So for example, a donkey is highly motivated to keep you out of danger. The horse is highly motivated to take you into danger. It's almost the opposite characteristics, which explains why we use horses to charge into battle. We don't ride donkeys into battle. As soon as a donkey sees the arrows, it heads in the opposite direction.
Did that answer your question?
I think I was kind of wondering, is science, do you think, going to be able to come to the an understanding of the difference between the biology and the consciousness of the mind and how that works? And then I guess a follow-up with that is, I know that there's a lot of talk with technology and how fast it's progressing and whether or not it's going to become integrated, you know, with nanotechnology, things like that, into your consciousness, into your mind. Is that an area that technology and science is going to be able to reach, or is it something that's going to be separate, the biology versus the consciousness?
Well, for the last 100 years, we've always been 10 years away from artificial intelligence that has consciousness. And the prediction is we'll continue to always be 10 years away from making that happen. Now, artificial intelligence research, and probably the best research that's been done at MIT, really shows that we're not going to be able to build an intelligent machine that has consciousness. We will be able to build machines that are able to do computations at a far more rapid and complex level than we're doing today. But that's different from a machine that's able to develop an emotional bond with you that means anything. You know, I can program a machine that will say I love you every morning to you, but that's a little bit different than having, say, your wife say the same thing to you. You know, sometimes she says it, sometimes she doesn't. I can program the computer to say that to you all the time, but it's just a machine. But the research I was referring to earlier is actually documenting that with respect to human beings, there's something about us that's non-physical. And as I said, that research has just started in the last 3 years. But it's really starting to support the Christian doctrine that there's a duality to human beings, that we're not just purely physical. There's something about us that's non-physical. For example, the human brain, in terms of its hardware, is not able to explain all the functions and operations of the human mind. There's not just not enough hardware there to explain it. It was Roger Penrose who made the point that what you see in the human mind is not just a computer. You see a computer, you see software, and you see a programmer. And it's the programmer part that the brain cells can't explain.
You know, but before you go, I believe it was about 8 years or longer that Francis Crick was doing a project at Caltech. And the project was the neuronal correlates of consciousness. Very directly responding to the question you were asking. And I remember reading one of the interviews with him at the time. And they asked him point blank, do you think that we will find that the brain is really the consciousness, that there's some epiphenomenon that the brain produces that is that just is consciousness? And at that time he said, I don't think so. Because right now the evidence is that we cannot find the neuronal correlates of consciousness. He did not foreclose the possibility, but he had a very dim view of it. And what, you know, that, what value that is to your question, I leave that to you. But Francis Crick wasn't a dummy, and he was working with some very smart folks at an institute that's well known for its smart folks. The philosophical question of, you know, mind-body dualism has been going on for centuries. I think that will be more properly answered empirically, but we may be, that may be the end of the question is, can it ever be tested empirically? And right now, the answer is, we haven't done.
Yeah, and I want to say something too before you do that. There's some really interesting research with near-death experiences. There is a small percentage of near-death experiences where people experience leaving an operating table, say, and floating out of their body and seeing something that they could not have experienced had they been awake sitting up on the operating table, much less being in a, you know, basically an induced coma. The example I gave yesterday was a woman who went into cardiac arrest. She left her body, floated up through the ceiling of the hospital, saw a tennis shoe on the roof of the hospital, and when she was revived, was able to describe it to one of the workers at the hospital. They went up on the roof, and the tennis shoe was up there, just as she described it. And there's hundreds and thousands of these that are in peer-reviewed journals now. This is becoming a more routine thing as we're able to bring people back from death, that they see things that can't be a dream in their head because they relate to reality. They relate to something that's actually in existence. And the implications of that are very interesting if you think about it, because it means that not only is there a part of us that is non-physical, like you said, our consciousness, but there must be, because they left their body, they experienced these things, and they came back and they remembered it, it also means that part of our memory is not physical. So I think that is a way to test it. I think if there's enough of these that are really well documented, it's going to get to the point where we really can explain consciousness from a purely physical standpoint.
Chimpanzees, I think, that are controlling robotic arms through computer connections, and that's kind of another idea of, is technology going to be able to integrate into that consciousness, or is that purely a biological response that they're able to summarize?
Well, for example, there's research where they're developing robotic arms for human beings, where this robotic arm is actually controlled by your brain. And so it's like there's something about the brain that's actually able to control things that are not part of your body. So yeah, we're looking at some amazing things out there. We promised that we'd have a drawing, so can we collect those cards and start giving away some stuff? We'll take a question while we're collecting the cards.
Yeah, well, I've got a question from the audience, Hugh. How conclusive is the evidence that no complex animal life existed prior to the Cambrian explosion? And before you answer that, would you explain what the Cambrian explosion was?
Yeah, the Cambrian explosion, dated 543 million years ago, is when you see this explosive appearance of about 50 different phyla of animal life forms. And has in the textbook says the first appearance of animal life on planet Earth. Before that, all you got are unicellular life forms and colonies of unicellular life forms. However, recently they did find two animal phyla that show up at 575 million years ago, which is called the Avalon explosion. So a little bit before the Cambrian explosion, you got two phyla of life showing up at the same time, and they exist for about 20 million years, and they go extinct, completely extinct. And so the planet reverts back to just unicellular life forms, and then shortly thereafter, you have the Cambrian explosion. Now, there's some geological evidence. What was happening between the Avalon and the Cambrian was a snowball event, where about 80% of our planet became frozen. And that would explain the disappearance of the Avalon animals. And then later you'd have the Cambrian explosion taking place. But the 50 phyla all show up all at once. Again, if you read the textbooks of, say, 30, 40 years ago, they were saying the Cambrian explosion extended over a 40 million year period. But there's evidence in China that shows that even the most advanced of the phyla that we belong to, the chordate phyla, was there at the very base of the Cambrian explosion 543 million years ago. And this is something that even Richard Dawkins has commented on, how all these animal phyla show up suddenly without any previous history and just come out of nowhere. Well, it's not exactly nowhere. What's happening is the oxygen content of the Earth's atmosphere is slowly rising, and the moment it hits about 10% is when you see this sudden explosion of animal life forms. Well, from God's perspective, for good reason, those animals can't exist until the oxygen content hits 10%. But the very moment it hits 10%, you see this explosion of creative activity. And it's something that's mentioned in Genesis chapter 1, creation day 5, let the oceans swarm with small animals. That, I believe, is a reference to the Avalon and Cambrian explosions. But it's recognized as one of the most profound challenges to the evolutionary paradigm, because it's the opposite of what the Darwinian model would say.
All right, let's give some stuff away. We have three things we're going to give away.
We will mix these up here. Don't pull yours again. I'm going to pull mine three times in a row. Ross Hoagland, come on. How about Mel Peters? Where are you? There you are.
Well, you got first, so you get your choice. 10 Breakthroughs of 2012, The Great Debate, Hugh Ross and Victor Singer, or Why the Universe is the Way It Is. All right, Hugh, you want to grab one?
Sure.
Alice Derarkinian. All right.
Which one would you like? The book. Somebody who reads. All right.
Peter Arkinian.
Well done.
Thank you, everybody. Would you be willing to comment on 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 in the first few verses, where he talks about the coming of the day of Christ and gathering together to him, and whether that's two questions that were answered with one answer, or one question that was answered with one answer, or how that worked?
2 Thessalonians chapter 2?
Yeah. Which is now concerning the coming of the day.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the passages. And I wrote something on that back in 1974. Still have it around on what that passage is all about. It's a passage that talks, from a premillennial perspective, Christ returns to planet Earth. and reigns on planet Earth for 1,000 years. And 2 Thessalonians talks about a time of trials before Jesus physically returns to planet Earth, and makes the point that there will be this rise of a world dictator that is evil, and basically organizes the nations of the world into a 10-nation confederacy, and sets up an economic system to rule over those nations. And makes the point that during the first part of the reign of that world dictator, Christians will know that he is the, you know, he's the one who's going to bring about this evil outcome. The non-Christians won't know, but the Christians will know. And then halfway through that period, everybody knows what he's up to. But during the first half, only the Christians. Because what will happen is that world dictator will not tip his real intent until halfway through that 7-year period of his reign. But the Christians will immediately know what's going on. Which means the Christians are going to have the opportunity of actually knowing the clock is ticking. And this will be a time when Christians will be incredibly active in sharing the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ. And an unbelievably large number of people will become Christians during that time. So that's kind of the basic message of that 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 8 through 12.
I was thinking specifically about verses 1, 2, and 3, I think.
Oh, the first three verses?
Yeah.
Not the controversial 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12?
No, they tie together, but it seems like that's controversial too. And where he's talking about coming the day of Christ and our gathering together to him.
Right.
That gathering together to him, do these events precede
our
gathering together?
Yeah, see, those first 12 verses are really dealing with this concept of the fact that there will be a 1,000-year reign of Christ here on planet Earth, where Jesus will be physically ruling here, preceded by a 7-year period. And during the first half of that period, as I've already mentioned, Christians will know that he is there. But the first few verses talk about what's called the rapture of the church, where God will come and take all the believers from planet Earth for a short period of time up into the kingdom of heaven. And it talks about a time when Satan is going to be allowed to deceive. That's kind of what 2 Thessalonians 2 is really talking about, the great deception. But how that great deception can't take place if there are believers around. So God takes the believers out so that the great deception can occur. Why does God permit that? Basically to shake people to their senses. They're going to wonder, why are all these people gone? Why is it that the virtuous ones are gone? And why is all this happening? And it begins to get them thinking, maybe there's more than just the natural realm to worry about. And they begin to see supernatural evil. Because the thing I've noticed, as I travel around the world, you run into people who believe there's nothing supernatural happening. And you run into people who think everything is supernatural. You get one extreme or the other. It seems to be Satan's tool to persuade people there is no God, there is no supernatural. And then when they become convinced there is a supernatural, hey, I'm the one who's getting all the supernatural power here. I'm the one who's in control. Don't worry about this God. I'm going to take over. So you get one extreme or the other. And this is what 2 Thessalonians 2 is talking about, is where people haven't listened to the scientific evidence for God, the historical evidence for God. So he's going to allow Satan for a short period of time to show people what happens when the supernatural is released, and they realize, whoa, I had no idea that there was a real risk. As Paul says, we don't fight against flesh and blood. We fight against principalities and powers. You know, I hear people arguing about politics. Politics is very complex and highly irrational. I mean, you wonder, why are politicians making the crazy decisions that they're making? Well, it's not new. That's been happening through all of human history. It's because it's not just human beings that are involved. They're angels and demons that are also fighting for the political control of this planet. So it explains a lot of the irrationality that's going on. But God's going to allow this irrationality to run at such a great degree that people are going to realize the supernatural is real, and it's a danger. And if I don't get right with God, then I'm going to be overwhelmed by all this supernatural evil that's taking place. Now, Jesus said to his followers, "You are the salt of the earth." And, you know, I often run into skeptics who will say, how come the God of the Old Testament is so vengeful and the God of the New Testament is so loving? God hasn't changed. It's people that have changed. Until Jesus rose bodily from the earth, there was no salt of the earth. So in the Old Testament era, because the salt wasn't around, you had entire nations and cities becoming completely reprobate in their evil. What does Genesis say about Sodom? Every man, young and old, came to Lot's door to commit homosexual rape. That has never happened in the New Testament era. There's never been a town or a city that's degraded to that point. Now, it will happen for a very brief period of time. Months, we're talking about. But that can't happen until God takes the salt of the earth away. So as long as the salt is here, it prevents that from happening. And prevents that lesson from being driven home to those who have not yet repented.
So that would put the rapture before the apostles.
My position on the rapture, and you can read the paper I wrote on this in 1974, is that the rapture takes place anywhere from 1 to 3 weeks before the middle of the tribulation period. In other words, believers will see the first half of the tribulation period. They'll be raptured before the Antichrist fully reveals himself, and they will not see the second half of the tribulation, but they'll return with Christ at the end of that period. So how long will the raptured saints be in heaven? 3.5 years plus 1 to 3 weeks. Say, can't you be more precise than that? Well, I believe people have overinterpreted the book of Daniel. When it says 1690 days, that means plus or minus 10 days. There's a reason why there's a zero after the 9. It explains why you get different figures in different parts of Daniel, because it's always plus or minus 10 days. And that's also borne out when Jesus said, no man knows the hour of the day. And when God put Noah in the ark, he had to wait another week before anything happened. No one knows the hour of the day, but you might know the month.
Do you see evidence of the wrath of Satan being poured out against the believing church before God's wrath is poured out against the unbelievers?
Well, what the book of Revelation and the Olivet Discourse and Mark and Luke and Matthew talk about is how just before this tribulation period occurs, number one, you're going to see a huge number of people becoming Christians. And I think there's some evidence that we're living in those days. Because in the year 1900, 2.8% of the world's population, pardon me, 2.3%, were committed Christians. The figure today stands around 17-18%. So 1500, it was 1%, 1900, 2.3%, 1950, 3%, 1980, 6%, today it's 18%. So there's been an enormous response. And the Bible tells us that's what will happen just before period takes place. Also says that there will be worldwide economic confusion. Some people read those passages and say it's talking about economic collapse. That's not how I read it. It's talking about economic confusion, not economic collapse. Which means that there will be no secure investment. Every investment you put your money into is going to go up and down. It doesn't mean the economy will collapse. It just means that there's going to be nothing really secure that you can count on as being a surefire money winner. And I think we're living in those days. 50 years ago, there were very safe investments. Now you've got to be really nimble to figure out which way it's going. And I've seen very wise investors lose a lot of money. I've also seen some make a lot of money, not just because they were smart, but because they were lucky. But the bottom line is this. God is allowing this confusion. And it's not just economic confusion, it's spiritual confusion. We were told this would be a time when there'd be a huge rise in new religions. I think we're living in those days. There's all kinds of new religions, and also there would be church splits and church cults, and the people would be confused. Well, the bottom line is, God is trying to teach us a lesson. The only thing we can trust, the only thing that's ultimately secure, is our relationship with God. The stock market might go topsy-turvy. The housing market might go topsy-turvy. Your church might go topsy-turvy. The only thing you can really count on is your relationship with Jesus Christ.
Yeah, there was a gentleman who told me that he has a PDF of that 1974 article that he wrote. Where are you? Okay, raise your hand so everybody knows who to look for. Thank you, Charlie. Yeah, you know what? Let's give him a hand for getting the coffee for super answer. Thank you, Charlie.
Mark, here's a question I think you can tackle. What are some of the features of the Christian worldview that make it a superior one?
Well, one of them is that if you compare the Christian worldview versus any other, it corresponds more to reality than the others do. And one of the things that you have to have the effective worldview, or one that you can say is supportable, is that the claims it makes on factual points are in fact true. So that's the first thing. The next thing is, does it collect from a wide variety of disciplines information that can be correlated? In other words, are we depending on just one stream of evidence or a multitude of streams of evidence? And for Christianity, the Christian worldview, it is a multitude of streams of evidence, not just one. In other words, we're not relying just on the Bible for our worldview, although the worldview is based on the Bible. But there are other things that can complement that, that show that the Bible is accurate. Another one is whether it is sufficiently broad enough to be able to encompass all of human experience. And the answer to that is yes. The Christian worldview specifically is designed and works to encompass all of human experience. In other words, it doesn't just take a little part of human experience and pretend to explain it or allow you to live it. It comprehends the whole thing. There are other features of it as well, but if you look at just those, and the fact that internally it's coherent, that there's nothing inside of itself that conflicts with itself. I mean, there's four reasons right there where I would accept the Christian worldview over any other. And that realize that worldviews can be compared with each other, the same way you would compare any other theories.
So I recently read an article about some Japanese researchers that were doing some interesting things with mice in the laboratory, specifically using stem cells to create viable eggs that they have then produced more mice from, and then also taking a skin cell, turning it into an embryo, and then being able to raise mice from that as well. Along with a lot of the advances that are coming in the medical community as far as, growing organs and things like that for human beings, do you think that there's a point where we're going to get to that playing God kind of attitude where we can, in fact, create life in the laboratory setting, and not necessarily from nothing, but, maybe rearrange life in a way that hasn't been seen before or done before?
Well, that was our lunch hour discussion today at Reasons to Believe. We had a scientist from Caltech come over and talk to us about, you know, what does stem cell research look like in the next decade or two? And are we ever going to get to the point where we can actually get organs? Kind of the status of the research, embryonic stem cells are not fruitful. When you're working with embryonic stem cells, you're too early of a point of development. And all you get are cancers when you work with embryonic stem cells. So you're much better off with newborn stem cells and adult stem cells. And the more complex the organ, the more challenging the stem cell problem. So, for example, Katie Galloway from Caltech was making the point that probably the first breakthrough is going to be using stem cells to make skin. And that would really help burn patients. And the thinner the tissue, the easier the technology. And so skin is probably the first big breakthrough we're going to see with stem cell research. And then the simpler organs. I mean, they're already using stem cells, for example, to help a damaged organ repair itself. So, and interestingly, it's the brain where they've had the greatest success, where they actually put stem cells into the human brain, where the human brain's got damaged cells, and those cells get restored. But we're a long ways from, quote, making a brain. And, you know, the other thing that has some possibility of success is the pancreas. The lung is probably the most difficult organ of all to try to get from stem cells, and then the heart, but the pancreas has some hope, and skin would be the easiest. But still, we're probably at least a couple of decades away from being able to use stem cells to make you a replacement pancreas in case your pancreas goes bad. Your best bet is still to have an identical twin, hopefully an identical twin where you don't share the same genetic defect. So, and actually, they're making, we've talked earlier about how they're actually developing technology to make artificial arms and hands. And that technology will come before we've got stem cells that make a hand.
Follow up question on the question that was asked about the Satan's wrath and God's wrath. In the book of Revelation, it talks about God's hand did not. Revelation 7, I believe, not harm the earth until the 144,000 are sealed. So if at the 3.5 year point that everyone will know who Satan is revealed for, is his wrath then prior to that 3.5 years, and then God's wrath is poured out after he's revealed? In Revelation 8, where there's a silence in heaven for about a half hour, could you also just talk about a little bit about that silence, if there's anything about that?
Yeah, the silence is addressed in Revelation 6:9 through 7:1. 6:9 talks about the dead in Christ in heaven, and evidently the dead in Christ are aware of what's going on. You know, Paul speaks in Corinthians, and we also have a comment in Hebrews, that the dead in Christ are like spectators. Mm-hmm. They can watch what's going on here on earth, but they can't interfere. So it's kind of like when you die as a Christian, you're given some kind of spiritual TV set where you can kind of tune in and watch what's going on, but you're a passive observer. But what it says in Revelation 6:9, the martyrs asleep under the altar are looking down upon the earth. They see all the evil that's being committed, and they cry out to Jesus, how much longer are you going to wait before you intervene and put a stop to all this evil going on the face of the earth? And what they're told is, wait a little bit longer. There are still some who will repent and join you. And so let's wait for those few that remain to join you. And then you read on in Revelation 6, and it makes the comment that all the people of planet Earth, every man, woman, and child, is blaspheming the name of God the Father and Jesus Christ. Now, that degree of blasphemy can only come from a non-Christian. Christians can't do that. Therefore, for that blasphemy to be universal to all of humanity means that the believers have been taken out. And then you read in Revelation 7:1, that these people who have been asleep in the kingdom of heaven, passive observers, are now standing before God from every tribe, language, and people, and standing before God and praising God for what he is about to do. Now, we're told in the book of Matthew that Jesus will not return until there are people from every tribe, language, nation, people group, in significant numbers who are followers of Jesus Christ. But Revelation 7:1 tells us that has happened at that time. So when is the rapture of the church? Sometime between Revelation 6:9 and Revelation 7:1. call it?
God's wrath is when?
Okay. The wrath of Satan is always under the control of God.
Mm-hmm.
So Satan is restrained in how much wrath he can express.
Mm-hmm.
And God only allows him to express enough wrath to get people's attention that they need to be paying attention to the fact that, hey, there's a God out there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's under control. And you see it throughout the book of Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
That as bad as things get, God is in control.
Mm-hmm.
And we're getting no more than what is necessary. Now, the last 3.5 years of the tribulation period are referred to as the day of wrath. And what is that wrath? Well, that's God's wrath being poured out upon the reprobate behavior. This is a time when things really get out of control in terms of evil. And God allows that to shape the few that still remain that can repent, to repent. Because some people need a lot of shaking up before they realize there's a God out there and he wants to love me, and I'm going to accept his offer to deliver me from my sin. Some receive that easily. Others take more disturbing. And so the day of wrath is designed to bring about sufficient disturbing just to shake out those last few that are going to respond. And so that's the purpose of that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a promise that once an individual repents and receives the offer of forgiveness of all sin from Jesus Christ, from that point forward, they are protected from the wrath. That wrath is only for the unbelievers, to bring them to their senses. And so throughout that entire period, the people of God will be protected from the wrath. And it's going to be kind of like what happened in the book of Exodus, where the Egyptians recognized that there was a difference between the Jews and the Egyptians, that the Jews living in Goshen, nothing was happening to them. The big plagues that were being poured out were only coming upon the unbelievers. They say, well, what about the Egyptians that wanted to repent? Well, if you read that carefully, what it tells you is that a huge number of Egyptians became Jews. They saw the plagues and they said, nothing's happening in the land of Goshen. We're going there and we're going to become Jews. And so people wonder, how did it get to be 3.5 million men from just 70 that came into the land of Egypt at the time of Jacob? It's because a lot of Egyptians decided we're going to become Jews. And the word Hebrew means believer in God. And so when the Exodus took place, only a small percentage were blood descendants of Abraham. The rest of them were spiritual descendants of Abraham, and that they were Egyptians and people from all parts of the Egyptian Empire that said, we want to be with the people of God. We want to become people of God. So the offer today is the same. Do you want to become a Hebrew? That's why it tells us in the New Testament that there are natural children of Abraham and spiritual children of Abraham. But all those who receive Christ as Creator, Lord, and Savior are children of Abraham.
With that, it's 9 o'clock. Last question. That was the last question. So thank you everybody for coming. Really appreciate it. I'd like to ask Mark to close us in prayer, please.
Thank you. Lord, thank you for bringing us together again tonight and for giving us a chance to explore your wisdom. We ask that as we leave here today, the questions that went unanswered would get answered, and the ones that were answered would be effective in propagating your word. I ask also, Lord, that we would continue to think through these problems as they never go away, and they're part of the way that you teach us things. May we learn and be instruments for your use and bring others to Christ as well. We give this all to you, Lord, in Christ's name. Amen.
Before you go, let me say one more thing. Those of you that did not use your 3x5 card to submit a question, would you please give us some honest feedback? What did you like? What could we improve? We're always trying to make these better, and we will be doing this again in probably about 3 months. So thank you, everybody, for coming.